Happy to be here sharing some reflections on practice with you tonight. How's the volume? Okay. Needs to be up a little more. Okay. Is that a little better? Is that okay? Sure. Okay. How's that? So. Everyone gave me such gracious instructions last time, and then I didn't actually clip it on. So, easy to forget. So sharing some reflections on practice. I actually prefer that phrase to giving a talk. I think I'm going to use that regularly. That feels more genuine and authentic to me than a talk. Because if my pre-pregnant brain kind of resisted compiling a neat outline and trying to get things to go into a linear fashion, the pregnant brain is even more that way. So it really feels more like compiling a mosaic. So working with themes and images and things that have been vital and important in my own practice of late, and giving them a shape that hopefully you can get something of benefit from. So what I thought we could explore together tonight and work with is the theme of, or the relationship between self-compassion and non-self. So how do these two things inform each other? So they can really seem quite separate. After all, we've given a lot of inquiry and investigation into the insubstantiality of this sense of self, how it's not independently existing. It's constantly in flux. So then what is it exactly that we're supposed to care for and show compassion towards? So how do we bring these two things together? And often I think there's a bit of a bias towards the wisdom teachings on emptiness and anatta, not self, and the compassion piece, or the cultivation of the heart, can kind of feel like a remedial step. I think when Christina was here, she called it, she said it's often treated as like the poor cousin of insight practice. So often, I think there's kind of an underlying attitude that if we can't have the deep penetrating insight into some of these principles, that at least we can kind of be kind to ourselves around that. And in my experience, I really don't see it that way at all. The practice of self-compassion and the investigation into non-self feel really interdependent and interwoven and really inseparable from each other. So I'd like to kind of work with that and experiment with that tonight. And it's not meant to be so much of a departure from Rodney's exploration of dependent origination, looking into the 12 links, but really an invitation to a kind of attitude that can underlie the whole exploration itself, a quality of heart that can affect the way that we're looking and examining and investigating. So it's kind of more in that spirit. A few years ago, my husband and I were in India traveling and staying in a small village above Dharamsala, above actually McLeod Ganj, the village where the Dalai Lama lives and the Tibetan community. And each morning we would come down this very steep, winding hill to get into the town. And there would be light coming in the morning, and there would be these groups of monkeys along the path every morning in clumps. And without fail, there'd be little clusters of them, and one would sit behind the other, and they would just be doing this very careful grooming process, which they would be just very carefully parting the hairs on the head of the one that was in front of them, carefully examining, looking. Every once in a while, they'd find a tick or a bug, and they'd pluck it off and maybe pop it in their mouth or throw it over their shoulder. And it was just this very, there was so much care in that gesture. But there was also a careful investigation. So it struck me at the time, in part because a lot of my early training was in a very meticulous, systematic investigation of the body, inch by inch, part by part, to try to see the absence of any solidity, any I, me, or mine. So it struck me, watching these monkeys, that what if we approached our investigation with this kind of care? How would that change what we see and what we discover? And the kind of reptilian part of our brain that's geared towards flight and fight, towards survival, is really getting a lot of airtime or press now because it's so well researched. This instinctual move towards fight or flight, that's really a lot of the instinctual drive behind our sense of self and our sense of separation in the first place. So this kind of reptilian part that they can look at in the brain and pinpoint. But equally instinctual and important for our survival is this mammalian part, is this caring part that tends, that attends, that cares and protects. So I think it's helpful to reflect that this is equally a part of our instinct, equally a part of our survival, and not always something we need to drum up or manufacture, but these are our equal drives. And they found with the monkeys that they actually spend 1/6 of their time grooming each other, which is quite a lot. And that there's a tremendous amount of pleasure that they derive from it. And actually there's more pleasure from the one doing the grooming than the one being groomed. So to actually care in this way is tremendously pleasurable. And I think often we are much better at grooming others and taking care of others than we are at taking care of ourselves. So it comes for some of us quite naturally to care for others first. So when we look into the process of self-constructing that we do, when we can notice moment to moment this coming together of form, feeling, perception, consciousness, all coming together in the moment, or these 12 links forming a kind of matrix that creates this sense of becoming, this constant constructing of a world that seems like it's providing us with a sense of continuity, a sense of sameness, a sense of solid identity. When we look at this and have glimpses into this, some of us over years, over 5 years, 10 years, 15 years of watching this process of constructing and dissolving, constructing and dissolving, it's interesting to notice, why aren't we immediately free of it? If we're noticing this again and again, why aren't we free of this process? Sometimes these are very profound glimpses. And we could say that maybe it's not because we've delved subtly and understood at a deeper level. But I think it's also because we haven't fully respected or honored the strength of the mental formations that Rodney was mentioning last week. These deeply ingrained habit patterns in the mind that assert themselves over and over again. So last week the homework was about this interplay of thoughts and emotions, how our deepest beliefs give rise to very strong, powerful emotions in the body, which feed those beliefs, and then the whole cycle repeats itself. So even though we can have these profound glimpses into the empty nature of the sense of self and this constructing process, these habit formations are so strong and deeply ingrained that unless we have some way to soften towards them and really respect their force and the residue that they've left in our bodies and in our hearts over time, I don't think a full integration is possible of our insights. So it's as though we need to have this kind of self-compassion in order to continue to see and to continue to look, otherwise it's too painful. So what's been very helpful for me is an instruction I heard, who knows from where, it was just scribbled on a scrap of paper somewhere, but just soften and widen. So soften the heart and widen the view. This feels like it brings the two together in a very simple way. So we can soften our heart to the full force of these formations when they occur, and we can widen the view beyond the personal, beyond claiming it for ourselves. So both of those can fully exist together. Jack Kornfield gave a recent talk on compassion, and this is what he said. We used to think and teach that being mindful was enough, that if you were aware, that everything else would take care of itself. And it seemed like a good idea. It did. But then we learned. We're a country that's misused almost everything. Why shouldn't we misuse mindfulness and meditation, right? That people could misuse it to become clear and open and do the spiritual bypass, spiritual detachment, and not actually embody awakening. Or they would use it to judge themselves and be harsh and critical and use the practice itself to feed into their own sense of unworthiness, in case anybody's ever noticed that. And so we really have to shift the way that we're teaching this to include the stream of loving kindness and compassion as the basis of our practice. Because the truth is that whatever level you're practicing on, however deep, you cannot open, not truthfully, not genuinely, without compassion, not fully. I think we can see in this and feel in this about how the opening and softening can actually enhance the depth of seeing and vice versa. So in this quote, he mentions spiritual bypassing, which is a term that's now heard a lot. It was originally created in the 1980s by a psychologist and longtime Tibetan practitioner named John Wellwood. And he saw in the course of his practice that people could be very advanced and awake and open in certain areas, extremely insightful and articulate, and leave whole other aspects of themselves kind of unevolved and uncovered. And in fact, that this was a really common thing that was happening in the West. And we've seen this and read about this with a lot of the great masters who were extremely prolific and masterful, but completely destructive and self-destructive in other aspects of their life. So there was this lack of integration. So I think this can happen in our own practice as well, especially if we've been practicing for years, that we can sort of subtly skirt around the areas that may be the most painful, where this patterning might be the strongest and the most deeply held, that especially if we're drawn towards teachings on emptiness and anatta, this can look very, very attractive if aspects of our human self are quite messy and uncomfortable. So I think we can see and we can all relate to the fact that in some areas we can be wide open and there's quite a bit of space and expansiveness and progress. But when we're reactive, it's really as though there's a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old in the room. So if you've listened to the voice in your head or the surge of emotion in your body when you're really caught in reactivity or in a difficult emotion, this is not the voice of a mature adult. It tends to be, I don't want to do this. This is crazy. Get me out of here. You can't make me. I don't want to. And so how do we meet this? After all of our years of sophisticated practice, how do we meet this kind of reactivity that can still hang on? I think it's Kitty Sorrow who talks about the hindrances being orphans of consciousness. So aspects of ourselves that we haven't been able to fully turn towards. So our approach towards this childlike reactivity is often one of kind of a more reprimanding adult. So we've been through this before. I've seen through this before. Why is this pattern still here? This kind of impatience and crankiness and demand. But if we can really turn towards this, it takes a great deal of humility and simply soften to the pain and discomfort that's behind that reactivity. I think it can do a lot of the work for us once we start to get to the investigation of what it actually is that we're made of. Otherwise, we're carrying forward the sense of division, and the division goes right into the inquiry. We're already divided, and so everything that we see reinforces the sense of inner struggle and division. There's this constant feeling of tension and battle. So take a breath. I've had the opportunity over several times over the last few years to be with groups of meditators who are learning about nonviolent communication, groups of long-term Buddhist meditators, really dedicated practitioners. And the trainers of nonviolent communication, I know some of you know this technique, are always really excited because they think Buddhists are going to catch on really quickly and it's going to be easy and they're going to really take to it. And in fact, the few times I've been a part of this, it's devolved into conflict and argument. Because just really briefly, the process of nonviolent communication is this, first and foremost, this inquiry and practice of self-compassion or self-empathy. So looking at any reactive behavior, looking at the feeling that was that arose from it, and the basic human need that was underneath that feeling, and then letting action arise from that. So it's a very simple process of self-inquiry and giving it the kind of care and attention. But in these conversations between meditators and the nonviolent communication folks, the meditators continue to insist that we don't actually have these basic human needs, that our drive and practice should be to transcend these, that to fully say, I have a human need or a human desire, is to reinforce it, to make it stronger, and to live our whole lives kind of governed by that. And so there's this extremely intense argument back and forth. But it's almost as if the indignation with which some of the meditators are insisting they don't have needs is in fact quite a needy thing. So it's been really interesting for me to watch, because my experience is that in turning towards whatever's arisen with this kind of willingness to see that this human body is wired with basic needs for safety, for connection, for freedom. And it may not be true on an absolute level that those are absolute needs, but that's how the human being is wired. And to not acknowledge that and be able to embrace the strength of that is to kind of shove those off to the side, and really they end up driving and governing the whole process anyway. So I had a really clear example of this. I was at Cloud Mountain on retreat. I was sitting on one of the big blue puffy couches eating a hard-boiled egg. And as so many of these things happen, it wasn't during a formal practice. It was in between. I was minding my own business. And all of a sudden, someone walked by who I didn't know. And out of nowhere, was filled with this just a deep kind of longing for that person to come and sit next to me. And it had been a very solitary few years of practice, and I felt quite isolated. And this seemingly came out of nowhere, just this urge for companionship on the path, for some shared presence. And it just seemed to come out of nowhere. And when I turned towards it, there was such an innocence in that arising that I could really see, I think more clearly than I ever had before, that this kind of need or desire didn't come out of a problematic, unworthy, flawed sense of self. It didn't arise from a flaw or a lack, that it was just the most basic human need for connection. It was there in a moment, fully present, and then it was gone and left in its wake kind of just a tenderness and a clarity. So that was amazing for me, because on the micro level, on the deepest absolute level, it was just an arising and passing. It was just a flood of sensations in the body, based on contact, based on coming together of certain causes and conditions at that particular time, and it was completely empty on a deepest level. It was there, flooded through, and it was gone. But on a human level, it's really important to see that there was an innocence there. So talked about ignorance a couple of weeks ago, the not seeing, that's the first link in the chain of dependent origination. And so this was a kind of seeing that the ignorance had a kind of innocence to it. There was no one to blame. There was no flawed being. And so there could be a real softening and letting go in that moment when those two could come together, those two levels of insight could come together. So if we continue to harbor this kind of self-aversion, we can't fully embrace what's happening. It's just an undercurrent that's present all the time. Sokhne Rinpoche, the Tibetan master, says something can be real but not true. So it can be not true on an absolute level, that there's no inherent independent existence, but it can be real for that moment, can be very real and very felt. So can we honor both of those? So I think it's helpful to recognize that the sense of self, when it's first formed, very early on, when there's the first sense of separation between me and the world, so subject and object, I'm here, you're there, internal, separate from the external, that bound up with that misperception is a sense of fear. Because automatically, if I'm here and you're there, and there's this separation, then I have something I need to protect and defend. So that innate feeling of fear is very, very strong, and something that I think we kind of underestimate the strength of when we go to dismantle the sense of self, that there's a tremendous amount of fear that can be underneath that, and layers of tension that have gone to protecting that. So we're working not only with a misperception, but also layers of fear and tension that we need to be able to meet and hold. So I was with a group a while ago at a training, and the teacher was explaining about the sense of self. And he had a whiteboard and colored pens. He was doing this very elaborate diagram of how the self is formed, how we stay attached to it, and there were circles and arrows, and it was all very complicated. And you could feel everyone in the room just kind of getting tighter and tighter and tighter and squintier, just like trying to get this intellectually, this sense of self, like, okay, what is it? What is it? And because he's a very astute teacher, he recognized this and put down the marker and said, okay, at its most fundamental level, the sense of self is tension. It was like this huge collective sigh of relief in the room. And so everyone could let go with that. And so I think it might not be exactly true that the self is tension, but our attachment to it is always accompanied by tension. And so that's our felt experience of the attachment to self, is some kind of tension in the body, in the mind, and in the heart. So when we begin our spiritual practice, it can feel like a self-improvement project. And this is what can drive us in the beginning, wanting to become better, wanting to become healthier, wanting to become improved in some way. And then as we learn about more spiritual concepts, this can turn into a self-dismantling project. Can really turn into, like, how can I, I've identified the sense of self as the problem in all of my suffering, how can I get rid of it? How can I deconstruct it so it's no longer an obstacle? But it's the same movement that's driving both of these, which is a kind of aversion, a self-aversion, can be driving both of these projects. And it feels to me that the sense of self loves nothing more than a project, whether it's an improvement project or a dismantling project, really likes that. So it doesn't so much just like the letting be. So again, it's widening the view and softening the heart. You could even say widening the heart and softening the view. We can get a very narrow, fixed gaze when we're attached to the small, isolated sense of self. So the essence is that we can continue to include, I know you've heard this again and again, can continue to include whatever's there. Whatever's arising in our present moment experience, if we can somehow include this, no matter how childlike, no matter if we've been there before, been there a million times, and we've seen that before, we've seen that pattern, if we can continue to include each piece, it can be a full embrace of whatever's there, so that there's no part left out. So a full embrace of our suffering, even of what's not maybe so sophisticated or pretty to look at. There's a sociologist called Lewis Hyde, and he wrote a book called The Gift. And I don't know if he knows it, but it's actually a Dharma book, but he thinks it's sociology. He's talking about generosity and how the practice of generosity in art, in religion, and in service can help bring us towards a sense of selflessness. And he puts it this way, and he uses the term ego instead of self. The ego's firmness has its virtues, but at some point we seek the slow dilation in which the ego enjoys a widening give and take with the world and is finally abandoned in ripeness. So this is a different way of experiencing the lessening of the attachment to the sense of self, is more of a slow dilation rather than kind of a cracking through or a breaking through. And I think in Rodney's terms, this widening give and take with the world, in which we're increasingly receptive to what's coming in and increasingly willing to give and offer and not hold on and cling, is, he would probably call it porousness. So it's an increasingly porous attitude and relationship. So this membrane becomes increasingly permeable. And then eventually, as we're maturing, as that membrane becomes thinner and thinner, like the quote says, it can be abandoned in ripeness. So there's an organic maturing process in which that barrier, that boundary, is simply no longer needed. We can just let it slide away. It served a function for a while, and it's no longer necessary. So in this way, we can continue to play at wherever we sense that boundary of tension. So we begin to not take it as seriously, but notice wherever it's there, and we can investigate and experiment and see, like, is this pliable? Is this really so fixed? So this fear that feels as though if I move in that direction, I'm going to shatter and break. So can we move slowly towards that, just sensing, is this really true? Is this boundary pliable and flexible? So for this last piece, I'd like to just give some specifics about what self-compassion can actually look like in the world in a practical level, in a practical way, in a day-to-day way. It can certainly look like the formal practice of metta or loving kindness directed towards ourselves, but it can also be a different kind of attitude that we carry and can show up in a few different ways, I think, that either we don't recognize or we haven't completely thought of or named. So I'll just mention a few of these. And the first of these is actually ethics. So our kind of vow of non-harming, however we take that vow, can start first with ourselves, can start with a very clear intention to not be harsh with ourselves, to not continue that attitude. And this is a kind of renunciation practice. So Ajahn Suchito puts it this way. In the very quality of opening, there is some sense that you are actually bigger than this, bigger than the mess of the mind. All of its strategies, psychologies, fears and doubts. Because you can open and respond to it, you must be bigger than it. But the first response must always be, I will not respond to myself with malice. I will not respond to myself with guilt. I will not respond to myself with demand. I will not respond to myself with harshness. I will put aside those. So you can feel kind of the fierce compassion in those statements. There's really kind of recognition of an internal integrity and worth, and a refusal to turn towards oneself with that very habitual common attitude of harshness. So not responding to oneself with guilt, I think, includes the guilt at not being completely awake, at not being completely there yet, and demanding that we wake up once and for all. So some kind of vow of non-harming for oneself. And you can feel, I can feel in these phrases how that offers a kind of space in the mind that we can then see more clearly. So you can't see clearly if you're continually responding to yourself with harshness or command. It's just the water is too muddy. So that's on an internal level, how our internal kind of sila can support clearer seeing and the development of wisdom. And then on an external level, there are practices of self-care that are often very difficult for us, that also protect this energy that we have to be able to see. So Thomas Merton says this: "The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to violence." And he wrote this, I think, in the early 60s. And I had two friends remind me of this quote in the same week, so I figured there was something probably to learn from that quote. Because when we take on the spiritual path, even though we've given up busyness and ambition in maybe the material sense, we can take on this array of very noble, worthwhile, good projects, Dharma projects in the spiritual realm, and get very caught up with that. And it's almost as though kind of a new amplified spiritual self can form around that, that also needs a lot of maintaining, and some part of that spaciousness and clarity can be lost. We can lose our balance. So the simile of the acrobats in the suttas and the texts is often used to describe this balance and self-care. So there are two acrobats who are trying to balance on a bamboo pole in order to perform their act. And the teacher's at the top, the apprentice is on the bottom, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to do this, how they're going to balance. And the teacher says, "Well, I think if I just protect you down there, take care of you, and you protect me, you look out for me up here, then we should be fine. We should be able to balance that way." And the apprentice says, "No, no, it's not that way at all. I need to take care and protect myself down here. You protect yourself up there. And that'll be a much better way to balance. And in doing that, we'll actually be able to protect each other." So this was affirmed as a more correct view, leading to balance. So in many ways leading to a balance of mind. And later in the sutta it explains that the real protection is mindfulness, is awareness. So we can care for ourselves on an outer level, but the true moment-to-moment protection is to continue to be aware. And this protects us and protects others. And eventually at some point there's no difference. But needing to start with the particulars, with the sense of something here that's worthy of care. I had a friend say the other day, "It's going through a really hard time in many areas of her life. It's just really hard to be awake right now. It's really hard to be awake." is the force of everything that was coming towards her with a sensitivity of heart, was feeling very difficult to meet. But there was so much wisdom and just uprightness in her presence, and there was a knowing that even though it was hard to be awake, it was even harder ultimately to not be awake. So there was a recognition there of awareness as being of the true protection. So I think one of the common obstacles to self-compassion is this fear that we're going to be self-indulgent or self-pitying, that we'll somehow collapse in our own suffering and that will reinforce our delusions and we'll lose our perspective and kind of wallow in this self-pitying and indulgence. But true self-compassion has wisdom as its backbone. So it's inseparable, again, from wisdom. And it's immensely sensitive to wherever there's pain and suffering. So it can see that in pity and in indulgence, there's a kind of collapsing, a turning away, and that separation is reinforced again and again, and that's painful. So it's actually painful to contract back. So in a moment-to-moment way, the self-compassion can stay very acutely aware of where we're being drawn back in to delusion, even if it feels like pity and indulgence. So it's often likened to a wise parent who, when the child goes off and falls off the bike and skins their knee and there's this wound, the parent comes in, offers what's needed, so offers a bandage, takes care of what needs to be taken care of, but also offers some soothing, doesn't completely dismiss the reaction of the child and the crying, doesn't say, we'll stop that, it's just a cut. But also doesn't completely wail right along with the child. It's able to do what needs to be done to care deeply, but it also sees the whole spectrum, that life is a series of bruised and bleeding knees, that this will happen over and over again, and that it takes care of what needs to be taken care of in the moment, without seeing the ultimate truth of that reaction. So what happens when we practice in this way is that I think it gives rise to tremendous patience. That we're committed to awakening, we're committed to understanding, however mysteriously that process develops, but we're also tremendously patient with ourselves. So there's a sense when we see these patterns again and again that as long as it takes, we'll be aware, holding this reaction as long as it takes. So there's a dedication to our own waking up that lets go of the demand that it happen right away, that can still be extremely committed, but doesn't make us cranky and resentful every time that pattern arises. So there's a tremendous patience. So if we continue to kind of jolt ourselves awake with a sort of harshness, we'll continue to require that harshness in order to stay awake. So it doesn't actually need that. A more compassionate effort sustains itself more naturally over time. So finally, self-compassion, I think, respects and honors our uniqueness and our unique path. So it sees that we're not ultimately separate, that in some ways our reactive patterns are all shared, but that the way that our path is unfolding is unique to each of us, that sometimes it looks like a very penetrating cracking through of illusion, a very quick breakthrough of light. Sometimes it looks like more like a slow dilation, a gradual maturing over time. And to really allow however it is, however it's moving, sometimes it's both. In whatever unique way our path is unfolding, to let that be. So this actually allows our path to unfold and our practice to unfold much more organically than if we're demanding that it look like someone else's. I had a friend who knows me quite well, and many years ago we were talking about the Dharma, and I was explaining about this bird who has the two wings. You know, it's often an analogy that the practice is balanced when wisdom and compassion are balanced. So the bird has one wing of wisdom and one wing of compassion. And when the two are balanced, then it can fly. And so I was explaining how in the first years of my practice, I was very attracted to just mindfulness, being aware, just seeing things exactly as they are, moment to moment, you know, no messing around. And how I really wanted to start to integrate more of the compassion, the softening. And he said, you know, Carrie, it might be that you just don't need to flap as hard. So I've thought of this so many times. And it just struck me as true over and over again, that when these are truly supporting one another, wisdom and compassion has a really profound effect on our effort. That there can be a deep letting be, because we've turned towards not only our kind of intrinsic vastness, but also our very vulnerable humanness with equal openness. And so in that, I feel like there can be a real deep letting be of the entire being, a softening of the entire being, and a real freedom. And so that deep letting be feels like the deepest expression of self-compassion, when we can really just let ourselves alone, and also an expression of wisdom. So we don't need to control or manage, come up with another project. It's very wise and very compassionate at the same time. So I had the honor and fortune this winter to be with my father in the final days of his life in November as he was passing away. And the timing worked out in the sort of miraculous way that I found out 3 days before he passed away that I was pregnant. And so sitting at his bedside and kind of staying with him through this process of slowly letting go of his body, kind of in and out of consciousness, and at the same time feeling this absolutely miraculous kind of life coming in at the exact same time. So kind of helping him in whatever way I could to let go, and at the same time just being sort of in awe of this like rapid cell division that was taking place, and differentiation and specialization in the body, something coming into form, making heart valves and ventricles and fingernails and eyelashes, and just the wonder of that. And then at the same time, in the same room, just this like immense letting go. And it was very powerful for me, and really made me reflect on how we're always poised in between these two. How we're always somewhere between the letting go of our form and the creating of new form. And that to try to be identified too much with either side will really create a lopsided view. And it's just quite actually wondrous to be in the middle of those two, allowing both of those two on a micro level and a macro level. It's on a micro level, each moment, life coming in, being created, and then falling away. So on every level, there are these, the dance of these two energies, these interplay. And so when we're fully with both of those, we can respond with patience and care and tending to what's coming in and what's going out. And also really have a very deep kind of learning about the relationship between the form and the formless, between what's bound and limited and what's boundless and limitless. And it's not that we need to take a side on either end, but to really understand the relationship between those two that's happening all the time, moment to moment. That complex relationship that we can fully participate in. So that's what really leaves nothing out. That's the full participation. So maybe we can sit for a minute. So I meant to read this poem at the end of the sitting, but maybe it's actually better now. It's from the Terigata, which is a collection of verses from the elder nuns in the Pali Canon. And I think it walks through just this process of tending to the particulars of the human form all the way through the seeing into the final letting go. So it's called Sister Patachara on Awakening. Washing my feet, I noticed the water, and in watching it flow from high to low, my heart was composed like a fine thoroughbred steed. Then taking a lamp, I entered the hut, checked the bedding, sat down on the bed, and taking a pin, I pulled out the wick, like the flames unbinding was the liberation of awareness. So sometimes liberation is referred to as kind of an extinguishing or a cooling or a going out. And it's also thought of as a flame that's being released from its fuel. So in this last image, like the flames unbinding was the liberation of awareness. I think this kind of self-aversion can be part of the fuel that keeps us attached to a small, narrow sense of self. So as you sit, just for another moment or two, I would just invite a kind of inquiry into your own experience, just as you're sitting. So just silently to yourself. might ask, what aspects of my experience are most difficult to include? Or maybe, what are the aspects of my experience that my spiritual self doesn't have the patience for, doesn't allow? And what's the felt experience of that? I appreciate your attention. Thank you.